Colleen Hoover's Too Late isn't just a romance. It's a psychological thriller that has taken TikTok by storm, amassing over 2.3 billion views under its hashtag. Originally self-published in 2016, this dark, mature novel found new life when republished in 2023, becoming an instant hashtag #1 New York Times bestseller. Unlike Hoover's other works, Too Late delves into the dangerous territory of toxic relationships, drug dealing, and undercover operations. What makes this book particularly compelling is how it forces readers to confront uncomfortable truths. Sometimes we stay with people who hurt us. Sometimes love isn't enough. And sometimes it truly can be too late to escape the consequences of our choices. As Reese Witherspoon noted after featuring another Hoover novel in her book club, Colleen has a unique ability to dive deep into human emotions while keeping readers frantically turning pages. In Too Late, that ability reaches new, disturbing heights. Sloane's life has become a prison of her own making, a gilded cage that grows more confining with each passing day. Each morning begins with unwanted intimacy from her boyfriend Asa, a man whose designer clothes and Mediterranean vacation photos mask his true nature as a volatile drug dealer with connections to dangerous criminal networks. Their sprawling beachfront home functions as a perpetual party house, filled with an ever-rotating cast of strangers passed out in bathtubs, lines of cocaine on glass coffee tables, and the constant undercurrent of potential violence. Yet Sloane remains, mechanically repeating her mantra, "One more year before I'm free." The truth behind her captivity reveals layers of heartbreak. Sloane believes Asa is funding the specialized medical care for her disabled brother, Stephen, at an exclusive facility in Arizona. With her support system completely eroded, her mother lost to a spiral of addiction and eventual overdose, one twin brother dead from a catastrophic seizure at 19, and Stephen requiring round-the-clock specialized care, Sloane feels trapped in an impossible situation. She's working part-time at a local boutique, carefully hiding cash tips in a hollow book, desperate for the day she can accumulate enough money to escape with her brother. "I throw up after we have sex sometimes," she later confesses in a particularly raw moment. "I pray every night that you won't touch me. I've learned to leave my body when it happens." These aren't the words of someone in love. They're the raw confessions of someone existing in survival mode, counting minutes until morning. What makes Sloane's situation particularly devastating is the calculated way Asa has systematically isolated her. When unknown addicts appear in her marble bathroom at 3 a.m., when Asa grips her arms hard enough to leave fingerprint bruises that she covers with long sleeves, when he monitors her movements through GPS tracking and surprise visits to her workplace, there's no one left in her world to raise an alarm. Her universe has contracted to revolve entirely around Asa's demands, his mercurial moods, his dangerous business dealings. She's become an expert at reading micro-expressions, calculating each word and gesture to avoid triggering his explosive rage or paranoid suspicion. The psychological warfare is constant. Asa alternates between lavish gifts and cruel manipulations, between promises of a better future and threats to cut off Stephen's care. He's systematically convinced Sloane that she's worthless while simultaneously making her believe she's crucial to his operation, a common tactic of abusers designed to create emotional dependency. Have you ever found yourself making excuses for someone who hurts you? Sloane's situation may be extreme, but the psychological mechanisms that keep her trapped, fear, obligation, guilt, and desperate hope that tomorrow might somehow be different, are disturbingly common in abusive relationships. As she moves through her days, we see a woman who has mastered the art of performing love while secretly plotting escape, a survival strategy that exacts a devastating toll on her mental and physical health. Her story serves as a haunting reminder of how quickly control can be lost and how difficult it becomes to reclaim. Carter, whose real name is Luke, is an undercover officer tasked with gathering evidence against Asa Jackson's sprawling campus drug ring. Working alongside his partner Dalton, who has infiltrated Asa's inner circle, Luke attends college classes to establish his cover while meticulously collecting information that could bring down Asa's operation. His days are filled with careful note-taking, both academic and investigative, maintaining detailed records of shipment schedules, dealer networks, and the complex web of student involvement. What he never expected was to meet Sloane in Spanish class, where she sat two rows ahead, her presence immediately disrupting his carefully constructed facade. Their connection is immediate and electric, sparked during a group exercise where they're paired together. They begin exchanging nonsensical sentences as a form of play. Walrus tusks cloud my vision like chocolate pudding, and one-legged tiger sharks are better for you than vegetables, creating a private language that becomes their refuge from reality. These playful exchanges evolve into deeper conversations, shared coffee breaks between classes, and study sessions that blur the line between surveillance and genuine connection. For Luke, these moments of authentic interaction stand in stark contrast to the role he's forced to play as Carter, Ace's new business partner, who must maintain a calculating, street-smart persona. Luke's professional and personal ethics collide when he realizes the depth of Sloane's situation, her unwitting connection to Ace's operation through her roommate, her vulnerability to the growing drug presence on campus, and her genuine trust in him. "I've never let a girl get to me like this," he admits during a late-night debrief with his handler, "especially one I'm not even dating." His growing feelings for Sloane compromises his focus on the larger mission, creating a dangerous vulnerability that Asa eventually exploits through surveillance and subtle threats. The moral complexity of Luke's position is what makes his character so compelling. Unlike his partner Ryan, Dalton's real name, who easily separates his undercover persona from his real life, maintaining a long-term relationship back home and treating the operation like a theatrical performance, Luke struggles with the deception inherent in his role. When Ryan suggests using Sloane's feelings to gather information, calling her the break we've been waiting for, Luke resists, unwilling to manipulate her even for the greater good of bringing down Ace's operation. His integrity becomes both his greatest strength and his most dangerous weakness. What would you do if helping one person meant potentially failing to help many others? This is Luke's constant dilemma, playing out in sleepless nights and moments of paralyzing indecision. His growing love for Sloane puts the entire investigation at risk, jeopardizing months of careful infiltration and the chance to stop a drug operation that's already claimed several student lives. Yet he can't bring himself to walk away from her, knowing that doing so might leave her vulnerable to Ace's influence. When he finally confesses his feelings, telling her, "I want everything about you, so goddamn much," we understand that he's crossed a line from which there's no return, choosing love over duty, heart over badge, in a decision that will have far-reaching consequences for everyone involved. Asa Jackson isn't just a villain. He's a study in how trauma creates monsters. Through his first-person narration, we witness the disturbing inner workings of a mind warped by childhood abuse. His father's lessons, "if it doesn't benefit you, it shouldn't fucking matter to you," and warnings about whores, have created a man incapable of genuine love or empathy. What makes Asa truly terrifying is his self-awareness, combined with his complete lack of remorse. He knows exactly what he's doing when he tampers with Sloane's birth control, when he monitors her movements, when he isolates her from potential support. "What attracts me most to Sloane is her innocence," he admits. "I like knowing I'm her first and only lover, and that I'll be the only one who ever has her." His possessiveness isn't love, it's ownership. Asa's drug dealing isn't just a criminal enterprise, it's a worldview. He categorizes people like drugs. Sloane is heroin, something you'd happily use every day. John is meth, cocky, talkative, painful. Dalton is cocaine, sociable and likable. This dehumanizing perspective allows him to use and discard people without remorse. Perhaps most chilling is Ace's lecture on relationships, where he claims men are breeders by nature, while women are nurturers who don't enjoy sex like men do. He justifies his own cheating as biological necessity while forbidding Sloane the same freedom, explaining that when men cheat, it's physical, when women cheat, it's emotional. This twisted logic serves as his justification for controlling every aspect of Sloane's life. The encounter with his father at a casino reveals the source of Ace's pathology. After violently attacking the man who failed to even recognize him, Asa breaks down completely, punching the dashboard until it cracks, crying uncontrollably despite hating myself for it. In this moment, we see the wounded child beneath the monster, but understanding the origin of his behavior doesn't excuse it. Have you ever wondered what makes someone truly evil? Is it their actions, their intentions, or their inability to change? Asa represents a particularly disturbing kind of villain because we can trace the path from abused child to abusive adult, yet he consistently chooses to perpetuate rather than break the cycle of violence. The tension between Sloane, Luke, and Asa builds to unbearable levels as their lives become increasingly entangled. When Luke and Sloane share lunch at a restaurant called Mi Amore, Asa discovers her location through GPS tracking. When they exchange meaningful glances at Sloane and Asa's engagement party, Asa's suspicions grow. Each interaction brings them closer to an inevitable confrontation. The power dynamics shift constantly between these three characters. Asa wields his financial control over Sloane and his position as a drug dealer over Luke. Sloane uses her understanding of Asa's psychology to manipulate him when necessary, while gradually transferring her emotional trust to Luke. Luke balances his duty as an officer with his growing commitment to Sloane's safety. Their interactions are filled with double meanings and hidden agendas. When Luke delivers a toast at Sloane and Asa's engagement party, his words about how love finds you in the forgiveness at the tail end of a fight and in the tragedies you face speak directly to his connection with Sloane, even as they appear to celebrate her relationship with Asa. When Sloane pretends to still love Asa after he breaks into her apartment, she's using the only weapon she has, his obsession with her, to buy time until Luke returns. What happens when love, duty, and survival instincts collide? The answer plays out in increasingly dangerous encounters. Luke and Sloane's first intimate moment in his car becomes both an act of defiance against Asa and a genuine expression of their growing feelings. When Asa discovers Luke is an undercover officer through an elaborate fake FBI raid, the confrontation becomes not just about the drug operation, but about Sloane herself, who she loves, and who has the right to possess her. The triangle reaches its breaking point when Asa forces Sloane to admit her true feelings. "I love Luke," she finally confesses. "I hate you." This moment of brutal honesty triggers Asa's final descent into violence, setting up the climactic confrontation that will determine all their fates. Throughout the darkness of Too Late, one element shines as a consistent source of hope: the unique language of love that develops between Luke and Sloane. Their habit of exchanging nonsensical sentences — "Pickles don't feel guilty when people yodel, so why aren't the sheets ever folded on Tuesday?" — becomes more than just a game. It's a lifeline connecting them across dangerous circumstances. These whimsical exchanges evolve into an elaborate code, allowing them to express deep emotions through seemingly random phrases. Each nonsensical conversation carries layers of meaning, building a fortress of intimacy that their adversaries cannot breach. This private language serves multiple purposes in their relationship. It allows them to communicate authentically in a world where both must constantly pretend, creating a safe space where truth can exist without consequences. It generates moments of unexpected joy amid their grim reality, offering brief respites from the constant tension. Their playful exchanges often occur during their darkest moments, transforming fear into connection. Most importantly, it represents the possibility of a different kind of relationship, one based on mutual understanding rather than control, where vulnerability becomes strength rather than weakness. The contrast between how Luke and Asa communicate with Sloane is particularly revealing of their characters. While Asa demands declarations of love, "Tell me you love me," and absolute obedience, treating communication as another form of dominance, Luke asks questions and truly listens to her answers, creating dialogue rather than demanding monologue. When Sloane reveals her brother Steven's condition, Luke responds with genuine interest and empathy, engaging in conversations about Steven's needs and interests. In contrast, Asa's discomfort and avoidance of the topic reveals his inability to connect with anything that doesn't serve his control. The moment when Steven offers Luke a blank paper and pen, something he's never done with anyone else, becomes a powerful symbol of the authentic connections Luke forms, even with those Sloane holds dearest. Written communication takes on special significance in their relationship, offering a tangible record of their growing bond. Messages on a dry erase board allow them to express feelings they can't safely speak aloud, creating a private archive of their evolving relationship. Worries flow from her lips like the random words that flow from her fingertips. I reach out and try to catch them, clenching them in my fists, wanting nothing more than to catch them all. Sloane's response, he unclenched his fists and dropped her worries, unable to catch them for her. But she picked them back up and dusted them off. She wants to be able to hold them herself now. Sloane's private language evolves into a powerful symbol of resistance against oppression. Like lovers throughout history who developed secret ways to communicate under surveillance, Luke and Sloane's nonsensical exchanges become a form of rebellion against Asa's control. Their shared vocabulary of seemingly meaningless phrases carries profound emotional weight, proving that true connection can flourish even in the most hostile environments. This linguistic intimacy becomes their most effective weapon against manipulation and control, demonstrating how love can create its own language of survival. As the story reaches its climax, each character must confront what they're willing to sacrifice for what they truly want. For Sloane, freedom requires risking everything, including her life, to escape Asa's control. For Luke, protecting Sloane means potentially compromising his investigation and career. For Asa, his obsession with possessing Sloane ultimately costs him everything. The most powerful moment of sacrifice comes when Luke puts his gun to Sloane's head as part of a desperate plan to save them both from Asa. It's a calculated risk, using Sloane as his bargaining chip, knowing Asa would never want her dead, but one that requires absolute trust between them. This scene inverts their usual dynamic. Instead of Luke protecting Sloane, they must protect each other through a dangerous deception. Redemption comes at a high cost for everyone involved. Luke is shot twice, once in the leg and once in the chest, before Asa is finally subdued. Sloane must confront the possibility that her pregnancy resulted from Asa's deliberate tampering with her birth control. Even in victory, there are no clean endings or easy answers. The epilogue, set 7 months after Asa's death, shows how Luke and Sloane continue to grapple with the aftermath of trauma. Sloane attends therapy, but still doesn't discuss what happened during those final hours with Asa. They visit his funeral, they're the only attendees, where Sloane offers a complex forgiveness. Every child deserves love. I'm sorry you were never loved. For that, I forgive you. We both do. The "we" she references isn't herself and Luke, but her son, Dalton, who might biologically be Asa's child. The paternity test they purchased remains unopened in their bathroom cabinet, a symbol of their choice to define family through love rather than biology. When Luke finally throws away that test, while Sloane watches with tears and a smile, they silently acknowledge what matters most. Regardless of genetics, this is their family now. What would you sacrifice for freedom? For love? For a chance to build something new from the ashes of trauma? These questions linger long after the final page, challenging readers to consider their own definitions of love, family, and redemption. Too Late doesn't shy away from the darkest aspects of human experience: abuse, addiction, manipulation, and violence. Yet within this darkness, Hoover plants seeds of hope that gradually bloom into something resembling healing. This isn't a story about trauma alone, but about what comes after, how we rebuild, reconnect, and reclaim our lives. Sloane's journey from victim to survivor is particularly powerful. Initially trapped by her circumstances and Asa's manipulation, she gradually reclaims her agency. When she finally stands up to Asa, telling him exactly how she felt during their relationship, "I throw up after we have sex sometimes. I pray every night that you won't touch me." She's not just speaking her truth, she's breaking the spell of his control over her. Her cookbook project symbolizes this transformation. By turning recipes I learned to cook while living with my asshole controlling ex-boyfriend into a resource for domestic violence victims, she's converting her pain into purpose. Even including Ace's favorite coconut cake becomes an act of reclamation. It feels like revenge knowing his recipes will help fund support for women who've suffered at the hands of men like him. The entire cookbook is essentially a middle finger to Asa Jackson. Luke's healing takes a different form. As an undercover officer, he's accustomed to compartmentalizing his feelings and experiences. With Sloane, he learns to integrate his professional duty with his personal ethics, finding a balance that allows him to be authentic while still fulfilling his responsibilities. When he throws away the paternity test, he's choosing to define fatherhood through love and commitment rather than biology, perhaps the most profound healing act in the entire story. Even Ace's character offers a complex meditation on the possibility of change. His final moments, spitting "fucking whore" and "I hate your fucking lasagna" before Luke pulls the trigger again, suggest he remained unchanged to the end. Yet Sloane's forgiveness at his funeral acknowledges the wounded child within the monster. Every child deserves love. I'm sorry you were never loved. This isn't absolution for his actions, but recognition of the broken cycle that created him. Can we truly heal from profound trauma? Too Late suggests that healing isn't about erasing the past, but about integrating it into a new narrative, one where we're not defined by what happened to us, but by how we choose to move forward. As Luke and Sloane build their life together with their son, they demonstrate that while some things may indeed be too late, it's never too late to begin again. At its core, Too Late is about the courage to choose love, even when every rational instinct screams for self-preservation. It's about recognizing that real love, not the possessive obsession Asa mistakes for love, requires vulnerability, trust, and the willingness to risk everything. When Luke first meets Sloane, he knows getting involved with her could compromise his investigation and put them both in danger. When Sloane begins to trust Luke, she's risking Asa's violent retribution. Yet they choose each other anyway, creating moments of genuine connection in a world defined by deception. Their nonsensical word game becomes a metaphor for this choice, embracing absurdity and joy in circumstances that offer little reason for either. When Luke is recovering in the hospital and whispers, "Porcupines don't wear hats in the summertime because their ears get too hot," it's more than just a cute callback. It's a promise that they can create their own meaning in a world that often seems meaningless. The pregnancy subplot adds another layer to this theme. When Sloane discovers she's pregnant and doesn't know whether the father is Luke or Asa, she immediately offers to get an abortion, worried about burdening Luke with another man's child. His response defines true love. "I'll love this baby regardless of biology because it's part of her," promising to be the best damn father that ever walked the earth. This stands in stark contrast to Asa's reaction to the same news. Initially overjoyed at the thought of his baby, he immediately rejects the child when he realizes Luke might be the father. "Even if this baby is mine biologically, it's been tainted by Luke. I don't want it anymore." For Asa, love is always conditional, always about possession. The final scene of Luke throwing away the paternity test while Sloane watches represents their mutual choice to define family through love rather than biology or obligation. It's a quiet moment that speaks volumes about the kind of relationship they've built, one based on choice rather than compulsion, on freedom rather than control. What would you risk for love? What would you sacrifice? How do you know when love is worth fighting for and when it's time to walk away? These questions have no easy answers, but Too Late suggests that real love, the kind worth choosing despite everything, is recognized not by grand gestures or intense passion, but by the simple freedom to be fully yourself with another person.